people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, arr, gar, gar. Pirate radio, where's my drum?
Now the N is for knots, or no, my bones are sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish it didn't get.
Pirate radio, arr, gar, gar.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Bukitas, who plays a sour note. W is tie is this, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 88.1 FM from the heart of occupied Washington. We are news from the front line. We can be reached at WSQTRadio@hushmail.com, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to This Week in Palestine, service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.immc.org, for April 16, 22nd, 2011. Conference on popular resistance in the West Bank as Israeli settlers continue attempts to evict Palestinian residents of Jerusalem from their homes. These stories and more are coming up. Stay tuned. Let's begin our weekly report, as usual, with the non-violent activities in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. On Friday, 16 civilians were injured and 4 arrested as Israeli troops attacked the weekly anti-wall protests in the villages of Belayin, Na'lin, and Al-Nabi Saleh in central West Bank, as well as the village of Masara in the south. In Belayin, 15 protesters were injured when troops attacked the weekly march. This week's protest in Belayin ended the three-day conference on popular struggle in Palestine. On Wednesday, the 6th International Conference on the Palestinian Popular Struggle started, which was dedicated this year to the Italian activist Vittorio Arrigoni, who was killed last Friday allegedly by a Salafist group in Gaza. The conference was aimed at providing opportunities to build and strengthen ties between Palestinian, Israeli, and international activists working against the Israeli military occupation in Palestine. The conference was attended by a number of Palestinian officials, in addition to members of the European Parliament and hundreds of international and local peace and human rights activists. International and Israeli activists joined the villagers and marched towards the wall built on farmers' lands after the midday prayers. Soldiers stopped protesters before they reached the wall and fired tear gas and rubber-coated steel bullets at them to force them back. 15 civilians were injured, including a journalist and 3 international supporters. The marchers continued forward and reached to the gate of the wall, as they have done on every Friday since early 2005. Later, soldiers forced people back into the village and stormed it, firing tear gas at people's houses. Many were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation. In 2009, the Israeli High Court of Justice ruled in favor of Belayin residents and ordered the military to reroute the wall, giving back the village half of the land originally expropriated to build the wall. the military still not adhered to the court's order. In the nearby village of Nalin, many were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation also on Friday during the anti-wall protest. Troops attacked the villagers using tear gas as soon as they reached the gate of the wall, which separates the farmers from their agricultural lands. In the meantime, two locals and two internationals were arrested when troops attacked the weaker protest against the wall and settlements in the village of Nabi Saleh. Palestinians, together with international and Israeli supporters, marched to their lands where Israel is presently trying to build a new settlement. Troops fired tear gas at them to force them back into the village. In the southern West Bank, the villagers of Al-Masara, along with their international and Israeli supporters, protested the Israeli wall being built on local farmers' lands. Israeli soldiers attacked the protesters before leaving the village using tear gas. Many were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation. In the Gaza Strip, a new initiative by the nonviolent activists of the International Solidarity Movement, ISM, was launched on Wednesday by sailing a fishing boat in the Gazan waters to monitor attacks by Israeli forces on Palestinian fishermen. The activists resolved to continue their human rights work despite the kidnapping and murder last week of Vittorio Arioni, who was a member of the ISM. Attacks on Palestinian fishermen are commonplace on the Gaza coast, with 53 fishermen having been injured in the last year by live ammunition fired by Israeli naval forces. In addition, 17 fishing boats have been confiscated indefinitely, thus depriving the Palestinian fishermen of their only source of livelihood. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas says France is supporting a declaration of a Palestinian state on 1967 border lines. This comes as Israel tries to block such a declaration expected at the United Nations soon. IMEMC's Rami Al-Maghari has more.
In a time the Palestinian leadership is preparing for declaring a Palestinian state on 1967 borders, garnering international backing to such a move, Israeli officials, including Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, expressed rejection, as Washington said it would consider veto against a possible declaration. Israeli position comes in the backdrop of demonstrations in Tel Aviv calling on the Israeli government to allow the establishment of a Palestinian state alongside with Israel, rather than leading the region to what the demonstrators believed further instability in the region. Washington, from its part, said it has been preparing a new peace plan that is based on the establishment of a Palestinian state with East Jerusalem as its capital and guarantee of Israel's security. Yet the plan does not refer to the Palestinian people's right to return to homeland in accordance with the UN's General Assembly Resolution 194. Neither Palestinian nor Israeli officials have responded yet to the US plan. In Europe, a meeting of the Quartet Committee for Middle East Peace will be held soon to discuss the Palestinian Authority's intention to demand a UN recognition of a Palestinian state. During a meeting of the UN's Security Council on Thursday, France understood the PA's demand for a recognition of a Palestinian state. On the internal Palestinian level, efforts are underway to bridge the gap between the rival Fatah and Hamas parties. Independent Palestinian bodies in Gaza met this week with the Hamas's leadership. No breakthrough was reported. Such a meeting comes as Hamas's officials said that the division with Fatah can come to an end if President Abbas answers a few Hamas's questions, including the political partnership and the political prisoners' profile. Last month, Abbas offered visiting the Hamas-ruled Gaza based on forming an autocratic government that would prepare for presidential and legislative elections, yet Hamas refused. Terms of Abbas and Hamas in power came to an end almost 2 years ago. Rami Al-Maghari, IMEMC.org, Gaza.
Attacks by Israeli settlers against West Bank residents and military attacks continue to target fishermen in the Gaza Strip. The details and more with IMEMC's David Steele.
The Israeli police arrested on Sunday evening Sheikh Raed Salah, member of the northern branch of the Islamic movement in the 1948 territories. On Monday at dawn, Israeli soldiers abducted six Palestinians in several parts of the occupied West Bank and took them to interrogation centres. The six Palestinians were detained after the army broke into their homes in Hebron, Bethlehem, Nablus and Ramallah. On Sunday, Israeli soldiers abducted two Palestinians near Bethlehem and Hebron. The army conducts daily invasions into the occupied territories, including areas that are ostensibly under the control of the Palestinian Authority. Palestinian sources in the southern West Bank city of Hebron reported Tuesday morning that Israeli soldiers broke into and occupied a number of homes and used them as monitoring towers. The homes in question are located near settler-only roads leading to illegal Israeli settlements. Sources stated that soldiers occupied the home of Ithsa al-Farouk, located near Beit Anunsair Junction, overlooking Settlement Road No. 60. The soldiers placed their gear on top of the home and prevented the family from moving freely in their own property. Soldiers also broke into the home of Omar Shabana at the entrance of Bani Naim town, also overlooking a settlement road, and used its rooftop as a monitoring tower. Furthermore, troops occupied rooftops of several homes near the Kiryat Arba illegal settlement in Hebron and restricted the movement of residents. The army stated that the measure was conducted in order to provide security for the settlers during the Jewish Pesach feast. Palestinian medical sources in Iraq Barin village near the northern West Bank city of Nablus reported on Tuesday evening that one resident was shot and wounded after a group of extremist Israeli settlers attacked the village and broke into his home. Israeli sources reported that the police arrested in recent weeks four Arab lawyers from the north of the country on suspicion that they delivered messages from detained Islamic Jihad detainees to the movement's representatives in the Gaza Strip and the other way around. The Palestine News Network has reported that extremist settlers handed out eviction notices to a further 10 families living in Sheikh Jarrah in East Jerusalem on Tuesday. A group of settlers from the Moscovich and Chibi Ali organisations allegedly delivered the eviction notices to the families, claiming that their homes belong to the settlers. Residents claim that the settlers forcibly entered one of the homes in question, taking photographs of the interior before the owners managed to expel them. The Wadi Hilwa Information Centre in Bir Ayub area in Silwan, in occupied East Jerusalem, reported on Wednesday at night that a Palestinian youth was shot in the face by a rubber-coated bullet fired by Israeli soldiers during clashes that took place in Silwan. The centre said that 20-year-old resident suffered severe wounds as he was shot directly in the face, including a serious wound to his lip, leading to massive bleeding. The wounded youth was moved to the Hadassah Ein Karem Hospital in Jerusalem. The clashes spread to other parts of East Jerusalem, while clashes also took place in the nearby Al-Turi neighbourhood as the army violently attacked the protesters. Furthermore, soldiers fired tear gas canisters and rubber-coated bullets at the protest tent in Silwan as dozens of Palestinians, Israeli and international activists were holding an education seminar. The soldiers tried to kidnap several children in Bir Ayub and Al-Bustan, but the protesting youth prevented them from conducting the illegal arrests. Soldiers and policemen managed to reach the protest tent that was installed to protest the ongoing Israeli violations, takeover of Palestinian homes by extremist settlers, and home demolitions. The police forced Palestinian, Israeli, and international peace activists to evacuate. The tent in Al-Bustan has become a symbol for nonviolent resistance in Jerusalem, while the army and police are ongoing in their attacks against the residents and their property. Palestinian medical sources in the Gaza Strip reported on Thursday evening that a Palestinian farmer was shot and wounded by Israeli army fire north of Beit Lahir, in the northern part of the Gaza Strip. The 45-year-old farmer suffered moderate wounds in his abdomen and was moved to a local hospital for treatment. The Israeli army considers all the border areas in the Gaza Strip as closed military zones and prevents farmers from working in their own lands there. Israeli soldiers driving armed vehicles and armoured bulldozers invaded on Thursday an area in the east of the Gaza Strip and demolished Palestinian factories in the industrial zone near the Al-Mintari crossing. After bulldozing the Palestinian factories, the army continued to bulldoze and uproot agricultural lands and also destroyed electricity transformer stations. Local sources reported that the soldiers also opened fire indiscriminately at nearby residential areas. Damage was reported, but no injuries. Palestinian medical sources reported on Friday morning that three residents were wounded when the Israeli army fired artillery shells at warehouses that were previously bombarded near the Karni commercial terminal, east of Gaza City. Adham Abu Salmiya, media spokesperson of emergency services in Gaza, stated that the three suffered mild to moderate wounds and were moved to Al-Shifa Hospital. The three were only identified by their initials, while their ages were 48, 41 and 31. They work at a local factory. For IMEMC.org, this is David Steele.
That was just some of the news from this week in Palestine. For more updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Thank you for joining us from Occupied Bethlehem. This report has been brought to you by Hassan Kassis and me, George Fushman.
Afghanistan, Friday. NATO is reporting the death of an occupation soldier from an insurgent attack in an undisclosed location in eastern Afghanistan on Friday, 22nd of April. Kandahar, Afghanistan today. After 3 months of hard work, 480 Taliban prisoners escaped from prison after their fellow insurgents tunneled their way in from the outside. The prison break has been compared to the Stalag Luft III escape from a Nazi POW camp during World War II, and some analysts say it could tip the balance during the upcoming fighting season. Afghanistan, Friday. Taliban militants launched another attack on NATO gasoline tanker trucks in northern Afghanistan's Maghlan province, Bakhtir News Agency reported. In the north, militants attacked a second coalition fuel convoy Thursday night in Dushi district of Maghlan province. The governor's office says two tankers were burned and seven others were damaged. Pakistan, Friday. A suspected U.S. drone strike in the Pakistani tribal region killed 25 people, according to intelligence officials. In Friday's attack, the drone fired five missiles on a hideout in Mir Ali of North Waziristan, one of the seven districts of Pakistan's volatile tribal region bordering Afghanistan, new intelligence officials reported. The officials said the militants, who were staying in the hideout, were planning to move into Afghanistan for an attack against coalition forces, but the attack also killed three women, and one of the missiles hit a house next to a targeted compound. Baghdad, Iraq. Easter Sunday. A bomb exploded near the entrance of the Church of the Sacred Heart in Karada, wounding two police officers and two civilians. Two other bombs exploded in Baghdad on Easter Sunday. Iraq, Friday. Two American soldiers were killed while conducting unspecified operations in southern Iraq. Wait a minute. What U.S. soldiers? What active operations in Iraq? I thought U.S. combat operations in Iraq were over. Wait a minute. That's been said before. Mr. Barack Obama, April was the deadliest month of the year for U.S. forces in Iraq. Pakistan and Afghanistan have been no Easter picnic either. Now's the time to pull the plug. Bring all the troops home today.
And no amount of money you could give me, honey, couldn't pay me, ain't going back again.
Obama, elected with the help of anti-war voters, got an embarrassing surprise on the morning of the 21st of April. He was at a fundraiser for himself in California when protesters who had paid big bucks to get into the fundraiser suddenly rose up and heckled him. There were signs and jackets demanding the immediate release of Private First Class Bradley Manning, the man accused of passing documents to WikiLeaks. Bradley Manning has been held without trial for three quarters of a year now. I'm going to weekend protests of Shota Bequanica, where it was held until last week. No doubt they'll show up at Leavenworth, and they showed up in California at an Obama fundraiser. Suppose Army recruiting ads had to have side effect warnings like drug advertisements on TV do.
The United States Army may not be right for every patient. Side effects can include distress, disillusionment, bitter resentment, isolation, traumatic and post-traumatic stress, sociopathic behavior, uncontrollable sobbing, uncontrollable violence, prosecutions for war crimes, prosecutions for domestic crimes, loss of contact with loved ones, loss of ability to love, brain injuries, blindness, depleted uranium poisoning, flashbacks, horror of death, horror of being away from death, loss of the use of limbs, loss of limbs, death, suicide, excruciating pain, the desire to feel excruciating pain, overwhelming rage and misery, loss of hearing, punishment by the Army for failure to obey illegal orders, punishment by courts of law or by enemy forces for obeying illegal orders, torture, humiliation, shame, dangerous habits of blind subservience, or the wasting of what could have been the best years of your life. If you experience any of these symptoms, deal with it, sucker. You already signed your name on the dotted line.
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 88.1 FM from the heart of occupied Washington. We are news from the front line. We can be reached at WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. From the 15th to the 17th of April, protesters deployed to the streets of D.C. against the spring meetings of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank on the anniversary of the great siege of the bank that took place on the 16th of April back in 2000.
Protest mixed with coal protest, power shift pouring into the streets to support it.
It all started the previous day, April 15th, as a small contingent from Jubilee, USA, carried gold bars around the meetings, demanding that the IMF and World Bank spend excess profits from the sales of their gold on canceling debts of poor nations. The next morning, militant anti-capitalist protesters hit the streets at 6 a.m. and found themselves confronting IMF delegates at the checkpoint set up for them to enter the meetings outside the IMF's headquarters. They're saying, loan shark, what do you say? How many kids have you killed today? At one point Friday, a fossil shark puppet, a loan shark puppet, circled the World Bank. This was after the march stopped by the Mayflower Hotel, where IMF delegates were staying for a wake-up call.
Right across the Mayflower. Charge!
Right there, a crowd of protesters burst through a line of motorcycle cops, charged across Connecticut Avenue and reached the doors of the Mayflower, but they were not successful in getting inside. That's been done too many times and the cops were expecting it. That's the sound of all those delegates to the IMF meetings being blown out of bed by vuvuzela horns and people yelling, World Bank, blood on your hands, at about 7 a.m. Next up was Rainforest Action Network marching out of Power Shift, joined by the same anti-capitalists that went after the IMF meetings in the morning for a joint march on Citibank, PNC Bank, and the IMF and the World Bank.
It's a charge against Citibank.
What do we do? Stand up, fight back!
coming in on Citibank. Rainforest Action Network wrapped up Citibank in yellow tape like a police tape saying global warming crime scene. Breakaway march starting to the World Bank. Way brought hundreds of people to the IMF and World Bank. So the Summer Rainforest Action Network had gone back to the convention center, a lot of power shift to join the march.
There's a checkpoint.
Once again, some of the IMF delegates were caught out, trying to get out for lunch or something like that. No limos were confronted in the streets by protesters.
Later that night, IMF protesters returned to Georgetown for the first time in a couple of years. After a second attempt to pay a wake-up call to the Mayflower sale.
After 2 days of street action, protests against the IMF and World Bank closed with a festival of resistance in Murrow Park, right across the World Bank, where economist Mark Weisbot had this to say about how effective protests against the IMF and World Bank have been since the great siege of the bank back on April 16th, 2000.
The IMF has lost an enormous amount of the power that it had 11 years ago. And all over Latin America, for instance, in 2003 in Latin America, you had about $57 billion of loans in Latin America. And now you have about $1 billion. And they're not telling any of the left of center governments what to do. And the same is true in middle income countries in Asia, in Russia. So it's been hugely reduced. Now, people don't realize that, I think, partly because there was this big comeback of the IMF since the world recession, right? They tripled their resources. They went from $250 billion to $750 billion. They've never had anything like that before. Most of the middle income countries in the world are completely outside their reach. And in Latin America, that's made a huge difference. I mean, if you look at Bolivia, for example, they renationalized their hydrocarbon resources. And there was something the IMF insisted on them not doing. They were under IMF agreements for 20 years until Evo Morales was elected. In 2005, 2006, he said he wasn't going to renew any agreements with the IMF.
Yeah.
They renationalized their gas, hydrocarbons industry that year, and they've greatly increased spending on social programs, on child nutrition, on pensions, on...
Like Bolivia, more and more nations are now turning on the IMF and World Bank, supported by global opposition to their policies. The very last act of the Festival of Resistance was a skit dramatizing this as a circus performance, with two people inside a tiger suit that moved very much like a real tiger, which was labeled as symbolizing developing nations. Two tiger trainers in the circus ring were labeled as the IMF and World Bank. And after ordering the tiger to roll over a few times and jump through a hoop labeled Natural Resources, the tiger turned on them, chased them around the ring, chased him behind the curtain, from which a faint sound of screams was heard. Is that how bacon bits are made? Anyway, speaking of bacon bits, way back in 2000, at the great siege of the bank, there was a banner that said, quote, "Today's pig is tomorrow's bacon," and they weren't talking about hogs with four legs. The IMF and the World Bank are on the menu and on their way out the door. Anywhere in the world, the IMF and World Bank try to set their hooks, people rise up and fight. The Latino nations are throwing them out. And when nations like Greece and Portugal beg for IMF bailouts, people rise up in the streets and fight them with every means at their disposal. Major battles were fought in Greece last year over an IMF bailout. Portugal will be next. And if they think they'll have any respite from Greece and Portugal, in Washington, D.C., they've got another thing coming. Every time they come here, the last 11 years, something different happens, and it's never fun for the spring or the fall meetings of the IMF and World Bank. the 18th of August, as thousands of climate activists march through the streets of D.C., some of them return the jar of BP's oil and tar balls to BP's D.C. headquarters. Huge numbers of marchers in the streets. The march set out from the Chamber of Commerce raised comparisons to the World Bank protest in 2000. Here it is, the main Powership crew rolling in on BP. BP right there. Genuine BP Macondo oil spill tar balls was left in front of the door of BP's government relations headquarters in D.C. on New York Avenue. Security guards complained that the jar of tar balls was a hazard and couldn't enter the building. But gee, BP, it seems to me you sure didn't consider those tar balls much of a hazard in the Gulf Coast when you were making decisions about how to go about drilling that Macondo well. So BP, don't be surprised when your gushers of oil bring a gusher of protesters to your doorstep.
The new Walmart's coming. Georgia Avenue, uptown, ain't that something? Small businesses, shop owners, hearts pumping, cause they know their livelihoods is about to take a thumping. You can't compete with a superstore who's an importer of slave laborers. Craftsmanship, low price to flip to undercut the market, hand over fist.
Walmart
is infamous for the way they behave. Low wage pay, treat the workers like slaves. Employees who try to use soon find themselves in unemployment lines. The way they treat women needs improving. 1.6 million sisters are suing them for being paid less than the male equivalent. On these issues and more, we can't afford to be ignorant.
Keep DC Walmart free. It won't benefit you or me. They ain't about spreading love in the community. They ain't about Chocolate City unity. Opportunity stop to make a buck quick. Suck up all your resources and then they split. They try to come across as if they legit, but really their motives are counterfeit.
This is the Funkinest Journalist with your three Walmart commandments. Step one, move in and crush competition by underselling. Step two, pay workers nothing and block unionization. Step three, take all that money, put it into the Walton Family Foundation, and turn that into political influence to protect yourself and make even more.
Walmart,
it's not a good fit for Chocolate City. Let me holla black at you with the skinny. Important that you clearly understand and remember, DC doesn't work with the right wing agenda. The Walton families are big contributors to bigoted representatives and senators. Trent Lott, sinister, Strom Thurmond, similar Confederate, state loving George Bush ministers. Oversee your plantation mentality, results in black and brown casualties. Statehood opposition for the district has been supported by Walmart's mischief. The D.C. Voting Rights Act was defeated, assisted via Walmart PACs, and now they wanna come here to see their money stack. Stay up on the facts. Chocolate City, don't relax and fight back.
Keep D.C. Walmart free. It won't benefit you or me. They ain't about spreading love in the community. They ain't about Chocolate City unity. Opportunity stop to make a buck quick. Suck up all your resources and then they split. They try to come across as if they legit, but really their motives are counterfeit.
Keep DC Walmart Free is an emerging activist group of D.C. residents stepping up to challenge the corporate big box invasion of Chocolate City. Walmart has plans to establish 4 stores in D.C. by 2012. Walmarts in D.C. will threaten small businesses, cause loss of more jobs than it will bring to the community, and lower the wage standards for all workers. To find out more and get involved, visit walmartfreedc.org.
The 18th of April, climate activists under the banner of Reclaim Power stormed the lobby of the Department of the Interior in D.C.
Here it goes! Charge!
That's the sound from inside the Department of the Interior as the lobby is occupied by opponents of mountaintop removal, coal mining, and other destructive oil, gas, and coal leases that the Department of the Interior approves. Here's what a speaker from Black Mesa, a piece of Native American land being destroyed by Peabody Coal, had to say about the Department of the Interior and extractive industries in the United States.
Hello, greetings to you all. Thank you for all the amazing energy that you bring here today on this day, beautiful day, that we are all here and we have the ability to speak out and voice out. In a lot of parts of this world, a lot of people don't have that ability and don't have that freedom to do what we do today as we're taking action today. I work with the Black Mesa Water Coalition, and we're based out of Flagstaff, Arizona. And where I'm from is called Black Mesa, and it's on the Navajo Hopi Reservation. And for the past 10 years, we've been organizing. We started off as young people, just like you, holding our governments accountable, our tribal governments here, the Department of Interior. Actually, one of our first actions was right here in 2001. And a couple years ago, I drove by here and I said, wow, remember about 8 years ago, we had an action right here. And, you know, now 2 years later, I'm seeing you all, you know, holding our government accountable. And for a lot of us as indigenous peoples, we see these energy policies that Department of Interior, Department of Energy, that is pushing on our indigenous peoples and our communities. These kind of climate solutions, they call it, like carbon capture sequestration. That is not a solution. This is one plan that they tried to push in our communities last year. And then another plan was to do, well, also uranium mining, more uranium mining in the Southwest.
Bigger boom! Super boom!
For the past 50 years, our people have been suffering from uranium mining and radiation exposure. So we know nuclear energy is not clean at all. And the question we need to be asking these federal agencies, where are they going to get the uranium? Not from indigenous people's land, that's for sure, because we are going to change that. Back in 2001, the way we started our organizing was to protect our groundwater, the Navajo Aquifer. The Office of Surface Mining, which is under the Department of Interior, allowed for over 35 years for Peabody Coal Company to use pristine water to slurry coal, to transport coal through a 300-mile pipeline that fed 5 million homes in the Southwest. At the labor of our people, at the health expense of our communities, and our pristine water, we cannot allow this unsustainable form of energy continue in this country. But also, for them to continue to take advantage of communities like mine, who still, a lot of people still speak our Navajo language, who cannot look at an environmental impact statement, an 800-page environmental impact statement. A grandma cannot read that whole document. That is unjust, and that is environmental racism. Supporters of the transition to clean, renewable energy, meaning wind and solar. But also, we need to create this transition plan so it benefits everybody, not just one corporation, not just one arm of an agency, We need a plan that's going to also give back to our communities. Currently, 50% of my people do not have electricity or running water. A lot of our kids still go on the buses every day and travel on dirt roads. This isn't America. So we need to make these connections between the frontline communities. It's not just in Appalachia, it's not just in Black Mesa, it's in the Powder River Basin, it's in Alaska. These are the connections we need to be making worldwide, in Australia, in Bosnia, in Venezuela. There are coal fights happening all over the world.
Yeah.
And how do we build this movement so it's just and that everyone has a voice at the table, not just a few environmental or conservation groups here in D.C. negotiating the future. It needs to be all of us. I just want to encourage you all to continue to learn, and that I also encourage you all to come to our homelands in Black Mesa region, where I feel very, very privileged today to have this opportunity to speak here in D.C. and share a little bit about my life and my community to you all, because not a lot of people in my community have that opportunity to come here and to say something and to express their concerns. So I just want to say thank you for this opportunity, for everyone who organized this. Two daughters now, and they're so beautiful and they're so precious to me, and I do this for them and I do this for the future generations and their great great grandchildren, and that's the way we need to be thinking, and that's the way we need to be planning. The Department of Interior and their energy policies are just another form of genocide to our people as Indigenous people. That train of thought that we must assimilate Indigenous people, Native people.
And how was that?
We have to take away their language. We have to take away their land. We have to take away their water. No! They have a trust responsibility to my community, to my elders, to my ancestors, and to the future generation. If they're going to have these policies being passed, they have to come out to my community and explain what they're doing and have input from my community. I've been a part of this way too long that I get to a point where I'm just so tired. But I just want to say thank you so much for all of your energy. And I encourage you all to continue to move. And next year and the year after, bring your people. Bring your grandma,
bring
your dad, bring your mom, bring your kids, bring your brothers and sisters. Bring them here, because that's the moment that's going to power and make the change. Yeah.
Out of the hundreds of people who stormed into the lobby at the Department of the Interior opposing oil, coal, and gas leasing on public lands, 21 refused to leave even when threatened with felony charges by the police, and at the end of the protest they were arrested, though I don't know on what charges. Remember that attempt to close the West End Library in 2007? The one where the required public hearing was held on the 5th of July, the day after the fireworks? Well, those fat pigs at East Bank have once again pushed legislation through the city council to let them close the library and build condos on the site, hopefully to include a new library in the end. Here's a sample of our own radio coverage of what happened last time after a second public hearing.
This is Dial Tone for WSQT Radio. Library closing alert. The City Council has passed legislation to sell the West End Library to East Bank, the same corporation that finances development in Georgetown. On Saturday, July 14, 2007, Joe Sternley, Vice President of Acquisition for East Bank, came to speak to the library. He was met with a crowd that had just been pumped up by an energetic rally outside, put together by Empower DC's People's Property Campaign, as well as some friends of the library.
Yes, sir. If indeed East Bank is does not want to be secretive, if indeed East Bank does not want to be secretive, then I take that to mean East Bank is for good government. As a member of this community, I insist upon a competitive bidding of ideas for this library site. And you want to write letters to Congress and ask them to
Now, with Fenty and the unwelcome spotlight he attracted gone, those fat slugs at East Bank think they can force the community to accept the closure of yet another library. Some community groups have given up and are settling for attempts to get concessions out of the deal. How about East Bank paying taxes to the city in excess of all that taxpayer money they will get to tear down a perfectly good library so they can sell condos for profit? How about we kick the rich off welfare and keep our libraries open?
Psychologist Stephen Reisner is an outspoken critic of those in his profession who participated in coercive interrogations or torture, which he says is defined as treatment that injures a prisoner for the purpose of extracting information. Reisner maintains that torture takes many forms, but that emotional and psychological techniques, such as sleep deprivation, isolation, and humiliation, leave more serious, though invisible, scars than the physical tactics that are usually thought of as torture, such as applying electric shocks or waterboarding. In early April, he appeared in New York District Court to press his complaint against fellow psychologist Army Major John Liso, who Reisner accused of unethical conduct for his role in the torture of prisoners at the U.S. military's Guantanamo Bay Detention Center in Cuba. The complaint accused Liso of recommending the interrogation methods employed against Mohammed al-Qahtani, an alleged 9/11 conspirator, that Reisner says included forced hydration, induced hypothermia, 20-hour interrogations, forced nudity, and religious disgrace. The complaint, which charges Liso of violating New York State professional standards, was supported by the New York Civil Liberties Union and the Center for Justice and Accountability. The Pentagon didn't respond to a request for comment on Reisner's complaint against Major Liso. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Stephen Reisner about torture and what he believes to be the ethical position a psychologist should hold regarding the issue.
I can tell you from having treated torture survivors that the non-physical forms of torture have a much more traumatizing and long-lasting effect than the physical forms of torture. So when you put electrodes on somebody or you give them a bunch of little cuts or you beat them up, it's terrible. But they don't have as hard a time being able to talk about having been tortured than when they've been humiliated or have gone crazy or have put in stress positions, which makes them feel that if only they hadn't moved in just this position, it wouldn't have hurt so much and they could have avoided talking. The psychological pressures that lead to people to break, the research shows that they have much longer-lasting scars and effects on people than the physical tortures.
Would you say that since Bradley Manning, the alleged whistleblower in the WikiLeaks case, is kept in isolation 23 hours a day, or any prisoner for that matter, is kept in isolation, that's torture?
Yep.
And the isolation alone, even if no other factors are present, has a really horrible detrimental effect for years afterward?
Not necessarily. That depends on the character of the person. I mean, some people don't get traumatized. There are certain things that we've all decided over the centuries are wrong. And abusing prisoners as punishment or to get information from them is, universally condemned, except at certain periods in time by certain regimes that until the Bush administration, our government joined in condemning.
Stephen Reisner, isn't it true that the American Medical Association and the American Psychiatric Association prohibit their members from being involved in coercive interrogations? What's the difference between these two groups and the American Psychological Association?
The difference is that the American Medical Association, the American Psychiatric Association, follow the World Medical Association. They basically say that the role of a health practitioner is to help people and not hurt people. It's based on the basic ethical principle of do no harm. And the American Psychological Association has decided that their people can participate in coercive interrogations whose aim is to cause prisoners to speak against their will. And the American Psychological Association has joined the Justice Department under the Bush administration in, you know, deciding that the same standards that would apply to any interrogator should apply to a psychologist. And that's different than other health professionals. The other health professionals see themselves first as a health professional. The American Psychological Association has created a new category of operational psychologist and have basically joined with the military in, you know, saying that clinical psychologists can be military combatants whose aim is to debilitate the enemy, get information, and use people as if we're at war with them to undermine their mental and physical state if it helps the war effort. The story is that I have brought a ethics case against John Lesso, Major John Lesso, who was one of the health professionals at Guantanamo on the team that created the torture protocols that were used on two detainees very specifically, and in general, just about all the detainees. Some aspects of it were used on all the detainees. He's a clinical psychologist licensed in the state of New York. Unfortunately, the Board of Professional Discipline simply refused to investigate. And so we brought a case in New York State Supreme Court to have the court order the Office of Professional Discipline to open an investigation. And my argument was that a clinical psychologist who uses his psychological expertise, who's hired as a clinical psychologist for the client, which was the military, and is hired to do harm to individuals, is violating the ethical principles of New York psychology, the code that we are all beholden to, in such a way that he should be investigated and his license should be taken away from him if it turns out that, based on the investigation, that this allegation is true.
That was psychologist Stephen Reisner. Find more information on Reisner's torture case against Major John Lesso on our website at btlonline.org.